Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, along with half an hour of sounds to greet the gathering darkness, although they'll work well in the morning too. Coming up, Shano singer and artist Kiara Conway on the uncanny side of being bilingual. Cuiva Lavelle wanders the lost Dublin of Gothic author Charles Maturin and composer Anna Malarkey on creating the sound of trauma and anxiety on the stage for the latest from Enda Walsh. And first, what does it mean to have two tongues? For bilingual singer and artist Kiara Conway, it could even mean being two different people. Conway is currently exhibiting as part of The Sky is Falling, a group exhibition at Ormiston House in Limerick, with a work called Gortiangach, looking at the psychic toll of losing a language, something which, as she told Culture File's Niamh Daly, has strong links to environmental collapse.
When I was looking more and more into what is lost, what a language is lost, either through colonization or through natural development, a whole section of knowledge is lost in terms of naming or mapping or those, you know, that intimacy that a community would have developed over eons is lost. So my name is Kiara Conway. I'm a visual artist and a vocalist, and I use several mediums in my work. So I use a lot of video and photography. I also use a song, songs I compose myself, or traditional songs that I draw upon and use in different contexts to explore issues and themes that I'm really interested in. For example, how we as individuals and communities, how we experience and express our feelings of loss, our anger, our hope in response to the many different issues in our lives. Everything from migration or the loss of language or the ecological crisis or death and dying, how that affects us. You know, the rituals we have at the moment compared to what we used to have traditionally. So I've always been interested in exploring language in my work because I'm, you know, I'm from the Gaeltacht and I speak Irish. I also sing songs in several different languages. So I'm very interested in language in terms of how you feel different when you speak it, or how language has been colonized and what that means and how it affects people. I always hear a sense of loss from people. Oh, I wish I had it. I wish I had it when I was younger. I wish I had the time to learn it now. Every now and again, there's a wave. And I think people are really questioning their relationship to it, probably in a more vocal way than we have before around the educational system. You know, I remember as a teenager in secondary school, you had to speak it, and therefore you nearly wanted to defy it and speak English. Do you know, as soon as it became a rule, you didn't want to comply. And it's quite heavy-handed to enforce a language. In 2022, myself and two other artists, Seán O'Sullivan and Chris Steenson, we were invited to take part in a research project called Crex, 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 curated by Cayman Walsh from the Ormiston House Cultural Centre. And we were invited to respond to the corncrake. So the corncrake is an endangered bird in Ireland. Many years ago, there were huge numbers of them in the country, but now those numbers have dwindled, mainly due to changing farming practices. And there are only around between 140 and 150 of this bird in the country at the moment. So as part of the research, we met with Corncrake Life. They are an amazing conservation organisation in Ireland, and they are working hard with farmers and local communities to work with farmers to change their farming practices and also to educate local communities around the corncrake and its habitat needs and what can be done to raise those numbers again. So I was really interested in the statistic that the corncrake is only heard where Irish is still spoken. So it's only really found in Gaeltacht areas. So there's a lot there around how a species or a language is pushed out to the margins. So the reasons why it survives out in these coastal areas is because farming practices are not affected. Not that there is no farming practices, but there are less out in coastal areas. So the bird was able to survive there. And also when you think about languages, you know, in terms of economics, like in rural Gaeltacht areas, it's not that it's not affected by capitalism, but not to the degree that it would be in an urban area. So languages, for different reasons, have, you know, the Irish language has survived for longer on these coastal regions. So it made me start thinking about language and species, both endangered and being on the margins, and also what it means when we might lose a language, or what does it mean when we lose the sound of a species in our landscape. So for example, we hear the cuckoo when we know the summer is coming. It was the same for the corncrake. You knew that it was a specific time of the year. And when we lose these anchors or these compasses, you know, how do we anchor ourselves in a place and in a time and in our seasons when all of these little markers, like, I don't know if we really know the value yet of what they are until they're gone. So I was interested in my own relationship to Irish and what it means to speak another tongue. And like the word bilingual in Irish, Cáhangach, means to have two tongues, which I love, because automatically for me as an artist, I think of a being with two tongues, you know, that it's nearly like being a different entity. And I started really feeling into more the embodiment of what that means. Like, what does it feel like to speak in another language? And for me, definitely, and for most people that I know that speak two languages, there's an awareness that your mouth changes into a different shape depending on what words you're using or where the sounds come from in your throat. And it's true, like when I was young, I have a really, really, really strong memory of when I used to speak Irish, of feeling old. And some of it is societal, do you know, in terms of probably cliches and maybe what's fed back to you around the Irish language. But definitely when I spoke it, I used to feel more guttural, more raw, more rough around the edges. I definitely felt like a different person. And, you know, I kind of leaned into that a little bit with this piece, because for me, then you're talking about shape shifting. You know, you're nearly talking about being able to step out of yourself, which is not that I'm calling it magic, but there's a definite othering which speaking multiple languages or two languages even can give you. You can step out of yourself because you actually physically become somebody different, which is phenomenal. But you're also looking at the world through the lens of a different language, which again is another way of being. So it's not a made up thing, it's actual. Do you know, it's an actual physical experience that is different.
Repeat after me. Ishka Ilam Tala Tanga Fairbon Bromas Nyantog.
Kiara Conway there, and Niamh Daly was the reporter. The Sky is Falling runs at Ormiston House until November 16th. A missing body next on the Culture File Weekly. Charles Maturin was a Dublin-born writer of Gothic fictions, best known then and now for Melmoth the Wanderer from 1820, his novel about a figure ensnared in one of those mysterious contractual obligations stickier than a Netflix account. Although Melmoth drew the attention of the 19th century literary world from Balzac to Oscar Wilde, its Dublin author is still lacking a permanent place of honour in the city. The latest edition of the Swan River Press's journal The Green Book marks Maturin's 200th anniversary this Halloween by bringing together new and old writing on Charles Maturin. Cuiva Lavelle took a wander with The Green Book's editor, Brian J. Showers, through what's left of Maturin's Dublin.
Where to mark the soul of the wanderer? Charles Maturin. Whose remains are somewhere, most probably in a storage unit.
My name is Brian J. Showers, and I've been running Swan River Press for the past 20 years. We focus mainly on literature of the supernatural and strange. Oftentimes it's contemporary writers that we publish, but sometimes we also tend to look a bit further back. In about 2013, I started a journal called The Green Book, which was sort of meant as a repository for some of the bits that I was finding during research that I wasn't really able to put into a proper volume.
I met with Brian J. Showers to do the only thing which Maturin admirers really have to connect with him. That is, beyond reading him. What we propose is a short walk, the same path he would have taken to and from work on a daily basis.
When I was putting together issue 23 of the Green Book last spring, a friend brought it to my attention that this autumn is Charles Maturin's 200th death anniversary. I thought it'd be a good time to maybe see what there was that I could maybe publish in the issue that would maybe commemorate him in some way. Maturin during his lifetime was celebrated, perhaps just briefly, as a playwright. He had written a play called Bertram, which had proven to be very successful in London. The novel that he's probably best known for today is Melmoth the Wanderer, which was published in 1820. The Gothic novel at that time was passing out of fashion. Jane Austen famously parodied the Gothic novel with Northanger Abbey in 1817, and Melmoth would have come along in 1820, just 3 years later. The piece that I found was a short sketch by the poet James Clarence Mangan, and it was published in the 1840s. It was part of a series of sketches that he was writing at the time. As I was going through it, I realized how much of the modern perception of Maturin, if people have a perception of him at all, comes from this article. Mangan gives us a sketch of an eccentric writer, which is more or less how he was viewed. He was known for having peculiar habits. Whether these are anecdotal or not, I couldn't say, but he seemed to have a fondness for dancing. He also seemed to dress in peculiar clothing. One of the more famous stories, which may well be apocryphal, is that he would paste a communion wafer to his forehead to show that he was deep in thought and that he was not to be disturbed while writing. Towards the end of the piece, Mangan wonders, again, this was in the 1840s, about 20 years after Maturin died, he wondered where he might go to pay respects to the great writer. And he had no idea. He didn't know where to go, and he had no idea where Maturin was buried. Now, it turns out that Maturin was buried very centrally, in St. Peter's Churchyard on Ainger Street. He was the curate of St. Peter's right up until he died in 1824.
We set off from St. Luke's, the Coombe, where the bones of Charles Maturin briefly rested. We strolled then to the site of St. Peter's, where Maturin worked as a curate. In St. Peter's Lane, all there was to see was a gated alleyway full of bins, and two are left at our feet, a deceased pigeon.
Over the course of the summer, I was working with another scholar, Fergal O'Reilly, and ended up commissioning from him a piece on Maturin's life, and in particular, his death. Fergal really investigated what had happened after Maturin had died, the trajectory from St. Peter's to St. Luke's, to eventually an anonymous storage unit. Where Mangan's piece is a little more sensational, highlighting Maturin's eccentricities, I think Fergal's piece is a bit more grounded. He seems to have found his birthplace on Camden Street, which I hadn't realized before, and it gives some insight into the conditions Maturin was living under and why he was writing. Today, if you were to go looking for St. Peter's on Ainger Street, you won't find it. It was knocked down a number of decades ago. And the churchyard where Maturin was buried went along with it. An excavation crew was brought in and the headstones were removed. Now, by then the headstones were completely eroded. The names were gone. The ground had shifted.
We strolled around to what would have been the front of St. Peter's, where now stands the YMCA. It had been coated in a thick layer of egg, which is customary this time of year. Then down York Street, where the Victorian pub The Swan was bustling, we spotted a mural to Maturin's great-grandnephew, Oscar Wilde. His mother, the poet Lady Wilde, also known as Speranza, revered Charles Maturin. This was although he died when she was very young. His memory had still made a huge impression on her. Oscar, as well, went by the name Melmoth in his last exiled days in Paris. On we strolled to the Stephen's Green end of York Street, where we were met by shiny buildings and a sea of white lab coats from the Royal College of Surgeons, which straddles this end of York Street today.
You won't find a plaque or even a building to put a plaque on. St. Peter's is gone, and Maturin's houses. He lived in two on York Street. They were also pulled down and developed. The Royal College of Surgeons now sits on the site where Maturin's homes were. It's a shame that we don't have a place to put a plaque or anywhere to mark the memory of this Gothic writer.
John Field's Nocturne No. 14 in C major, played by John O'Connor. And before that you heard Quiver Lavelle on the trail of Charles Maturin. The sounds inside your head are the territory of composer Anna Malarkey. Malarkey's work in the theatre has seen her creating the soundtracks of trauma and anxiety, finding synthetic and acoustic techniques to invoke the inner spaces of characters on stage. Most recently, she's been working with the playwright Enda Walsh on Safe House, a song cycle come gig set in a handball alley, in which she finds the sounds to shape Walsh's desolate lyrics of blended innocence and experience. Anna Malarkey spoke to Culture File's Niamh Daly about the musics of an emotional landscape.
A lovely part of the work is that you get to meet new people and like kind of get to like step inside someone's head and try to figure out what that sounds like alongside my head.
I am Anna Malarkey and I'm a composer. I compose primarily for theatre soundtracks or live soundtracks with theatre, and I also compose for film soundtracks, documentary soundtracks. But within that, I guess electroacoustic would be what I like to do. So blending synthetic sounds with acoustic sounds, and be that classical acoustic sounds or like a folk style where it would be maybe more improvisation and leading musicians with tracks. So there's a few projects that I got to work on where getting inside the mind of the people in the project was really, really interesting. So one of the projects was Feats of Modest Valor, which was a documentary around Parkinson's. So the soundtrack was really trying to look what it sounds like in the brain, because there was a lot of like conversations around neurology. So I used a lot of like synthetic sounds that sort of sounded almost watery, but then had a lot of movement. So that's more of like a very scientific approach of getting inside the head. And then I got to work on a play and did a live score for a play called Selvage. And this was around primarily a character, an anxiety character, that would come out and have a dialogue. It was a one-person show with James Reardon. And the dialogue of this anxiety character and our main character, Joe. And so I had to like come up with like, what does anxiety sound like for Joe? And what does that feel like? And how can we sonically represent that? Would have been like in the room with Lara Campbell, the director, and James Reardon. We would have played them together and then kind of gotten feedback. And I think that was more of a feedback loop from the three of us. So that was definitely, that was like a very different look at the mind of a character. I think I had like maybe 10 variations of anxiety. Some were motifs that would go on for a while, and some were just like a trigger of like a short 3-second sample. And all of them were largely synthetic, aggressive sounds made on multiple synthesizers. And then some of them had like a whoosh, so they had like this chorus effect that would go around. And that was kind of like that idea that when you're anxious, you kind of have this feeling that goes around and around. But then some of them were more direct. So just like having those different sensory experiences for that feeling. Something I've always been extremely interested in would be trauma. And trauma can be so much. It can be so many things, big and small. And I think they can be minute ways you react because of something that's happened to you before. Like my sister Mia is a director, and so we've done a lot of work together. And we did a project called Mother and Baby. It was about the mother and baby home in Tuam. And yeah, that was like a really deep project, and that had a lot of trauma. And I think when I have the pleasure of working on a soundtrack, it's really important to reflect trauma both in its feeling and then maybe a little bit of healing as well, you know. And I think in Safe House, that's something that I was thinking about, that like I wanted to make sure that we have those experiences, like you're in it, you're completely in it, be it a memory or be it when you're there. Both have the same, the feeling can be just as strong. There's a really good book called The Body Keeps the Score, which is about how the body holds trauma. I read that during the project and it really resonated with me, that even if you're in a memory, your body is still there. And so some of those tracks, she's in the trenches and she's really experiencing some of those traumatic events that happened to her. And then it's so important in the soundtrack that it's not just that, that it's maybe minding her too, that there is some music that actually heals that memory. Grace, the central character in Safe House, lives in the present day in a handball alley in Barna. She lives in a world that has rubbish around her, and it has nature around her, and it has the city, and it has countryside. So how do we balance that? What I wanted was that we have some synthetic sounds. You know, I'm not going to stay away from it being fake. I want it to be fake. I think that's important, that it, you know, maybe people go, oh, that sounds like a fake instrument. I'm like, yeah, it is, because there's, you know, rubbish around her. So that's important. For this particular piece, I wanted to try listen to the world as she listens to the world. I actually went on a holiday with my sister to New York, and I took a recorder with me, a Zoom recorder. I ended up taking a lot of the metro, the doors opening, the doors closing, and these sort of harsh sounds. And I was trying to think, I know she isn't in New York, but I feel like sometimes sounds in themselves are enough to evoke where someone is mentally.
Anna Malarkey there in conversation with Niamh Daly. Safe House runs at the Peacock Dublin until the 16th of November. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more Half-Light Signals on RTE Lyric FM next Saturday tea time and whenever you're ready for the podcast. Till then, bye now.